clients, colleagues, and friends of the firm. Welcome and thank you for joining us for today's Uniquely Rockefeller Special Client Event. Today's event is the 41st in our series and will be a conversation between Rockefeller Capital Management President and CEO Greg Fleming and Chairman Emeritus and Senior Advisor to Vanguard, Jack Brennan. With that, it's my pleasure as always to introduce Rockefeller Capital Management President and CEO Greg Fleming.
Thank you, Tom, and good morning to clients of Rockefeller Capital Management, to our colleagues, and to other friends of Rockefeller, and welcome, as Tom said, to the 41st in our series of special client interviews, which we commenced way back in March of 2020. It's my great pleasure today to have an individual who's closely affiliated with Rockefeller Capital Management, Jack Brennan, who actually was on the third client interview that we did in this series way back in April of 2020. And he's now back for the 41st episode of our Rockefeller client series. Jack Brennan, John J. Brennan, is Chairman Emeritus and Senior Advisor of Vanguard. He joined Vanguard in July 1982. He was elected president in 1989, one of the youngest presidents in the history of the financial or really any business world, served as chief executive from 1996 to 2008, and served as chairman of the board from 1998 to 2009. Vanguard's assets under management when Jack started were approximately $5 billion. They are $7.5 trillion approximately today. But that's just a statistical benchmark of success. Jack was instrumental in creating the culture, the firm, the ethos that led to the incredible impact of Vanguard on the asset management industry. He's also a director of Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, American Express, and we're proud to say Rockefeller Capital Management. He's chairman of the Board of Trustees of the University of Notre Dame, a founding trustee of King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, chairman of Vanguard Charitable, not surprising given Jack's constant focus on giving back, founding chairman of Catholic Investment Services, co-chair of Ready Nation CEO Task Force on Early Childhood, which again, I can tell you is not just something on his bio, he's dug in on that. He's past chairman of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA. I served on the board while he was chairman, the Financial Accounting Foundation, and the Investment Company Institute. He's a proud graduate of Dartmouth and Harvard Business School. He's received honorary degrees from Mount Aloysius College, Curry College, Drexel University. He's also a husband and father, and candidly, and this is why we're lucky to have him with Rockefeller Capital Management and here today, he's one of the true leaders of our time. An anecdote before I turn it to Jack and get him involved here. When I was at Merrill Lynch in the mid to late 90s, I started something called an asset management CEO roundtable. And I would get the CEOs of the leading asset management companies, which was an incredible growth industry at that time, to come to an event for a day, day and a half. And when Dave Kamansky was the CEO of Merrill Lynch, he would come. And then at some point, Stan O'Neill would help me host it. And in order to get the other asset management CEOs to the event, Larry Fink, our own Jeff Shames, Jim Reapy from T. Rowe Price, all sorts of people across the industry, the key was Jack Brennan, because he was the one who was setting the mark at Vanguard. And once I had Jack Brennan locked down, you know, I would say to people, well, Jack Brennan's coming. The attendance would follow. My dialogue with Jack was about substance at the meeting. Jack would say, listen, I'm happy to come and see my peers and even play a round of golf, but we're going to talk about things that matter too, aren't we, Greg? And then I had him. So that's the man. Jack, great to have you here today. Thanks for coming back on our program.
It's great to be here. And that story brings back a lot of memories, Greg, of, you know, this industry, which is a great industry. We compete like crazy, but you know, in the end, when it's about how do you help the economy or help investors broadly, we can also work together. And we've been fortunate, right, to compete with people we actually like at the same time. And sometimes you go full circle and here we are working together.
Exactly. So Jack, let's get into the incredible career you've had. Can we start with what drew you into this business and how you ended up in Vanguard? And I actually picked that as the first question because your skill set would lead you to success anywhere, as it has in a lot of other things that you are interested in and your family's interested in. So what was it about the investing business in Vanguard that attracted the young Jack Brennan out of Harvard Business School?
Well, I actually had a stop after Harvard for 2 years with a fantastic private company called SC Johnson Wax. I was actually headed to New York to be in the investment business, and I got an opportunity to go out and work sort of as a floater for the CFO and the CEO at this wonderful company. And it was a fantastic 2 year experience. And I have to say, I learned so much. I always called it Harvard Business School 2.0 for me. World-class people, world-class company with unbelievable values. It's private, always has been, always hopes to be. So that was a very valuable stop along the way, Greg. And, you know, the two-year itch, it happens, right, with people after they get out of law school like you or business school. And the investment business had a lot of appeal. It was not an appealing business at the time. You know, this is my fun fact I always give to people. When I started at Vanguard, the yield on the S&P was higher than the PE on the S&P.
That's incredible.
Okay, so it was not a place that people were rushing into. By happenstance, almost, Vanguard reached out to me. And, you know, it was such a differentiated place when I got to know it over a couple of visits that the place seemed interesting. We can talk about it was not much of a competitor in those days. But the business itself, and you know this, the investment business is so appealing if you're intellectually curious, if you like competition, if you like the fact that you're going to have demanding clients that you're going to engage with on a regular basis. To be honest, I don't think there is as interesting a business as the investment business. And that's what drew me to first talk to Vanguard, and never looked back. 40 years later, to be 40 years, a couple of weeks that I started at Vanguard, and I thank my lucky stars every day that I got to the best firm in a fantastic business. It's never been a dull day, right? Some days they're good dull, some days they're bad. Yeah, I mean, good exciting. Some days they're bad exciting. But you know, you pick up the New York Times in the morning, something on that front page affects what we do. And that's why. And it's, you know, it's why when I talk to young people about the business. And then in the end, and the ultimate to me is you're doing good things for people in this business, right? You're creating better financial futures if you do your job well. And so you get all of that plus some satisfaction. You see it with your clients. You know, I get stopped continually where somebody says, I just want to say thank you to you and your colleagues at Vanguard. You know, I have a great retirement, or my kids went to college on a 529 plan or whatever. That makes it all worthwhile at the end of the day.
That's really so well said. I remember during the credit crisis, I used to be defensive of the wealth management business, the asset management business, because the financial industry was under such pressure. And I would say, wait a minute, these are good businesses and they do important things for Americans across the country. You know, whether you're managing money for an institution that takes care of teachers in retirement, or, you know, all the work we do at Rockefeller Capital Management across our wealth management business, taking care of families, generational planning, and you know, paying for college. And these are businesses that one can be proud to be part of. And I know you feel that strongly, and I do as well.
And you always have to come back to the human element in that, right? It may be CalSTRS, but it's the teachers who are the beneficiaries in retirement of what CalSTRS does. And I know I found that to be a great personal mantra. And in at Vanguard, you always come back to somebody. I think some people think I'm a little edgy. Somebody say I'm just a small investor at Vanguard. And I'll say, there is no such thing. And I'm not being flip about it. And I say, my first account at Vanguard was opened on a Fidelity cash reserves check for $1,000. And it was our entire it wasn't our net worth because we had a lot of school debt. So we had a negative net worth, but it was our entire liquid assets was $1,000 at Fidelity. And I moved it to Vanguard. So there is no such thing in my mind. And so when you see generational stuff like you do at Rockefeller so well, always coming back to that individual who's the ultimate beneficiary. It's not an institution. It's not the endowment at Yale. It's the students who benefit and the researchers who benefit from the endowment at Yale. And I think that's, it's not unique to this industry, but it's a really powerful motivational force.
100%. So now you did say, and I know how proud you are of what Vanguard has become. And as I started up front, how instrumental you have been in that. But there were the early years. I mean, it was, you know, Vanguard was not a celebrated name in 1982. So what was it like when you first got there? I mean, and it's also not in a major urban area. So, you know, it's not New York, it's not Boston, it's not. So tell us a little bit about Vanguard in the early years when you got there.
So Vanguard started in 1975 with 13 employees. It was a couple of hundred when I got here in 1982. Candidly, the man who had really run the place every day had left the company. So I'd say we were a little undermanaged, if it would, to be kind. We had an inspirational visionary leader in Jack Bogle, who had founded it, which is who I came to work with and for, and that was the appeal. And so it was a scrappy place. It was a scrappy place. I mean, we were hustling like crazy. We had outsourced IT. They had smartly insourced customer service, which mattered a lot as a competitive differentiator. But to a great extent, we were money market funds and a fund called Windsor Fund with a man named John Neff who ran it. And he was the most highly respected mutual fund manager, and probably he and John Templeton in the country. And that's kind of what it was. And it was 800 numbers and coupons in the newspaper and those kinds of things. But a tremendous group of young people who would go on to, from being a phone associate to leading this rapidly growing enterprise. So there was a ton of spirit. And it was, you know, you were the underdog. It was, I'll just tell you one anecdote, which I did. You know, I grew up in Boston, know a lot of my father knew a bunch of people in the industry. To a person, they said, don't go to work for Jack Bogle. He was too tough to work for, blah, blah, blah. And my father gives me that readout and he goes, you're going to take the job, right? And I said, absolutely. And, you know, we were great partners for 13 or 14 years. And so, you know, between a vision and then a bunch of scrappy people who really wanted to win, it was a fight. It was a great place to be. It was a lot different than Johnson Wax. Let me put it that way. But I was able, because I get probably more, not probably, I got more responsibility than I deserved. I could bring some of the learnings from a great company like SC Johnson Wax to try to help us grow into something that might be meaningful down the road. And Jack was, he's like, bring it on, you know, whatever you know, whatever you've learned. And there are a lot of secrets in there that helped us get from, you know, a bit player to modestly successful.
Yeah, modestly. Any one or two inflection points along the way that stand out in your mind that, you know, when you, and I don't know how many employees there were and there are today, but, you know, everything is, this is 10, 50, 100 times bigger on every metric. So what were some of the inflection points that created that journey?
Well, one of the key ones was, in a sense, to say we're going to make a product and find people to buy it. Right. So we made, people want us to do this or that, separate accounts, all this stuff. We said, you know what, in our structure, we can deliver commingled investment vehicles, mutual funds generally. And they can be bought by somebody with a $1,000 IRA or somebody with a $100 million pension account. Critical decision. And so you had to move from the 800 number world to selling to institutions and selling and attaching other services. But that a product and find markets was a big decision, because lots of people go the other way. They create a whole bunch of different vehicles and they don't stand for anything. We stood for the world's best mutual fund. So that was a critical decision. Internally, one of the great decisions, Greg, was this was something I learned at Johnson Wax. We made everybody there, you start a partner in the company. And not literally, but we created what we called the partnership plan. And it was amazing to see the reaction of people. Turnover rates went down, our performance improved. and having 100% of the people have a little stake in how we do for our clients was an unbelievably powerful force. I'd say two other big ones, there's a lot of them, but betting very big on technology when we could afford to do it finally, 7 or 8 years into the time I was here, was huge because it brings scale, it brings a whole bunch of things for us. And then we were very early in betting a ranch on the internet in the day. So we could have reach, quality, offload a lot of the work to the clients along the way. The last one I'd say, fast forward into the beginning of this century, and we were behind in ETFs, we were behind in serving financial advisors, and we just said we're going for it in a major way. And now, you know, the outcomes of that, it's wonderful for us that Rockefeller Advisors can sell Vanguard products.
Yeah.
Not the case 25 years ago. They could, but they wouldn't. And that was a big decision. So those are four or five, some operational. I'll tell you though, but one of the most important was aligning rewards with mission in this compensation scheme we put together for people. You know, and this is not being a partner at Goldman Sachs by any means, but it was really a great lesson. And I've gone around and preached it to client companies who want to know how do you make that happen.
Well, you know, and so many things in that list. I mean, Rockefeller technology is so key in 2022, and that's front and center on everything that that we're focused on here, as well as aligning incentives, and as well as creating that culture and that ethos.
It's been one of the fun things to watch, right, over the last 4 years, or is it 40? When did you say? I forget when this all started.
Some days it feels like four, and some days it feels like 40.
But from day one, right, what are we trying to accomplish? How are we going to accomplish it? How are we going to use technology to make sure our advisors are as good as they can be and our clients have all the information they want? You know, it's a very simple, as you know, you and I have talked about it. There are a lot of lessons, shared lessons in our early days and Rockefeller's early days today. You guys actually have some money. We didn't.
Well, we're going to come back to that, but I want to get to the investing side because so many of the people listening want to hear from you on this. So you've got lessons embedded in both of your books. You wrote the second one nearly 20 years later. What caused you to take the second one, you know, the pen in hand, and do it again and come back to it?
So I wrote the first one at the inflection point of the bubble, of the NASDAQ bubble. And the noise out there, the disadvantageous noise, the money losing noise that people are subjected to was so high that I sat down and wrote it and just said, you know, here's what matters. During the pandemic, you get gamification, you get meme stocks, you get Bitcoin, you get all this stuff that it just felt like 99 revisited. And the fun part was to sit down and say, okay, so I'm good. So I reread the first book, which I hadn't done in a long time, and said, what here endured, and then what needs to be updated, and what's different than it was 20 years ago. It's a really fun exercise. You know, the core of the principles unchanged. The data that backs up the principles over the subsequent 20 years, completely verifying of cost matters, discipline matters, the simple stuff that gets lost in the headlines and the TV shows. But then, you know, some really great stuff has happened as well over that 20 years. You know, the couple of things I'd mentioned, you know, the advice options that are available today. You know, Rockefeller Capital didn't exist. A singularly focused enterprise that only wants to provide advice to clients. Didn't exist 20 years ago, right? So implicitly, there's parts of what I talk about in the book. That's what I've learned in watching you guys evolve into this deeply specialized firm. And what you do, and it goes to the other end of the spectrum where for 25 basis points, you can get a robo. Couldn't get that either. It's still better than a sheet that says, you know, are you an 8 or a 10 on the risk spectrum, which is what it was 20 years ago when you think about it. So advice, really important. You know, I think one of the great tools that's arrived over this period of time, not just for the tool itself, but how it can be used, ETFs were a fringe element of the business. It's a multi-trillion dollar business today. And I think it's a really important tool for people to use when investing. And then looking forward, you can see some things are going to come in a much broader spectrum, like access to privates, access to other alternatives that are really important, my own view is, one of the messages in the book about that is, it's a great thing, but make sure you get a trusted partner and advisor before you do it. You guys obviously do that. You have a wonderful platform, but it's going to be a great thing for investors. So the noise, and I had a little time, right? I've been traveling a lot, and I said to my wife the other day, I missed the pandemic because of the overhead, right, of travel. But I had a little time, and it was fun. And, you know, you go back and you say gamification. That's we're not going to talk about that anymore. You know, the idea you're going to get rich trading crypto probably has been dissuaded. People have been dissuaded. You know, trading your way to wealth in a pretty short period of time, I think people have learned a lot of those lessons. So it's important. Anyways, it's a fun exercise to do because I'm one of those people who actually likes getting older. You don't get smarter, but you get more experience. Then somewhere in there, there's some wisdom.
Well, you know, one of the things that you said that I want you to expound on for the listeners is the smart money smart? Volatile market now, what do you mean by that?
So, you know, if you look at the data and say who has consistently delivered outstanding results for their clients, if you will, the best endowment managers, university endowment managers, are a cohort of people who have done that well. And so I think the answer to the question is yes, but it's yes, but like anybody, they can make mistakes. But the yeses in there, I think there are a lot of lessons for any of us as individuals or families or financial advisors. And to me, the lessons that you learn from looking at the Yale Endowment or the MIT Endowment or the Notre Dame Endowment, who are sort of consistently at the top, are a few. One is they think long term. And when you sit on an investment committee at a place like this, you realize, you know, how the S&P futures are opening this morning has absolutely zero relevance to their life, right? So they tune out the noise, which is important, and they really do think. They're very diversified, right, which is important. And if you just look at a pie chart, they look over diversified, but the key to the way they diversify is they find ways to uncorrelated assets that they hope each can generate alpha. Good lesson for all of us again. And then I think maybe the most important point for why they're smart, at least in my view, is, you know, they don't call their managers, investment managers, managers, they call them partners. And they find people and firms they can trust. And it's a critical part. Again, it's what you guys are doing at Rockefeller, is to be that trusted advisor. So, you know, by the time you get thinking long-term, diversified, but not diversified in the sense of paying 100 basis points for a closet index fund, diversified into a bunch of subcategories. And then this idea that they have, they want permanent long-term partners. That's why if you study the data, they win. Better than pension funds, certainly far better than most individual investors. And it's not an easy game. But that's to me, and it's actually an important, I think it's one of the most important chapters in the book because, again, you'll remember, they got over their skis, a lot of them in 2008, didn't realize how much they owed for capital calls and other things. So they're not flawless by any means, and sometimes they drift. But when you look at David Swensen or the people, the guys at Notre Dame, the guys at MIT, boy, they just don't stray from what they do, and it's really critical.
Jack, I was going to come back to this, but as we're in the flow, third book. Another 10 or 20 years. I mean, the industry is continuing to evolve pretty quickly here. What changes do you think we're going to see in the industry and in the way that the industry serves investors?
So I think the core won't change, right? People can say you're reading yesterday's newspaper, but if you go back, the fundamentals of markets don't change, right? They may get disrupted, but eventually equities should do the best because you're buying a call on growth, right? And if you believe the economy is going to grow. So should equity still be a core of your portfolio? Yes. Does diversification work? Yes, but don't be over-diversified. You go down the list of things. But, you know, when I think about it, I look out and think investment product cost is going to continue to come down. You know, I think something like private equities, they're going to be retail share. I think those prices have come down. I don't think the cost of advice necessarily will come down much more, come down some in certain segments. But I think investment product cost, I think you're going to continue to see indexed investing take the core of the beta responsibilities in a portfolio. And that's going to create a very differentiated look to active equity management and maybe even active bonds, which is going to be higher risk, higher reward, highly concentrated. And you'll mix the two, and that'll be a core part of how people think about advice. I think that'll be a norm back then in the future. You know, what I hope, Greg, and we were talking about this yesterday, I hope one of the things the book would be able to build upon is the great education around investing in personal finance that Americans get in their education system, which they don't get today, I have to say. You know, the sort of basic building blocks. I would love for, you know, Straight Talk 3 not to have to even talk about it, because it's like gym class. Everybody knows how to build, bounce a basketball. And that's the other one. But for me, the most important message is I literally don't think, I think the core tenets of how we should all invest successfully were true in 1920. They're true in 2020, and they'll be true in 2040 and 2120. And it's how you make it happen. But that's fun part about the business. Although, you know, one of the things, there really aren't that many innovations when you think about it, particularly for retail investors over time. Mostly it's packaging. And So I don't know what the next big innovation, I think of ETFs as the last big innovation in sense, and online advice and stuff, probably part of it, but that's the fun part, right? So the question is, how do you win in that game as an investor or as a firm?
Yeah, Jack, some of the things that have been going on, and you referenced it, and I pretty much know where you are on these things, but listeners want to hear. Let's start with ESG. The role of ESG going forward in the investing world, it's become, it's getting a lot of attention, both from a regulatory standpoint. Are you doing it? Are you doing what you say you're doing? Is it more of a fad? You know, I've argued that, I'm raising millennials and Generation Z, and a lot of the things that are embedded in ESG investing are things that they worry about now and will in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So how will ESG unfold here in your eyes going forward?
You know, in some ways, I agree with you. I think ESG is real. You know, we've been through SRI and a bunch of other things over the years. I think ESG is real. I think the E was the thing that made it real, not just a fad. And then we've had a whole lot of social unrest and other things that have added to it. But so I think it's very real. And what I think will happen, Greg, is it's going to become the norm. And, you know, all the commentary about are you describing it correctly and all those things. I think it'll be interesting to see in 20 years if it's even a topic, because it's become so embedded. You know, it's like good governance, if you will, post Sarbanes-Oxley. You think about how companies changed the way they govern themselves post Sarbanes-Oxley. I think market pressure will continue to, it'll just marginalize non-qualifying companies under ESG standards, if you will. Yeah. And it'll just be what we expect, just like we expect great governance from companies today. And generally, we get it as investors. And I hope that's the case, to be honest. I think it would be a great thing if 20 years from now, you know, it just was, if you're not there, you're not, you don't, you're out of business if you're not very attuned to environmental issues, social issues, and so on. But I think that over the next 20 years, it's going to be rapidly growing part of the business. And not just because of, I think it's been highlighted. I think the younger people have driven it. Actually, Europeans have helped us. They're ahead of us on this, right? And yeah. And then it's an awareness creator for others that I think is a very positive, a positive force.
Yeah, you know that the Rockefeller family were one of the pioneers in the space, coining the phrase impact investing in the Rockefeller Foundation way back in 2007, which is a long ways back in this space. We've got a lot of expertise in Rockefeller Asset Management. We opened the office in London to serve those European investors because it's so core to investing in Europe. So you know, we believe as a firm that this has real traction.
You've got experience that most firms don't have. That's what struck me when I first got to know the firm. You've been doing this in live for 25 years in terms of products available to the marketplace. And, you know, that's one of the challenges right now, right, is everybody wants to be the standard setter. There's a little bit of a feeding frenzy, and then everybody wants to say they're an ESG investor. But particularly with the heritage of the family, you have, you know, deep roots in this and experience, you know, good and bad, right? We all have good and bad investing experience. And that's, you know, I happen to think it's a huge opportunity for you guys as you continue to develop as a firm.
Yeah. Jack, let's go to another one that you referenced earlier you know, also gets a ton of attention, which is crypto. We'll put blockchain aside, which I think is a completely different topic. But crypto you know, Bitcoin and the whole space, I mean, obviously major volatility here as the market has shifted with the Fed and inflation. How do you see that in the near term and over time?
So I'm glad you called out the technology. The technology, you know, blockchain hasn't had the adoption rate that one would have thought 5 or 7 years ago, but it's going to be important in some ways. My challenge with trading crypto, if you will, is I actually like listening to Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett about it because I haven't agree with them, but I won't be as pithy as they are. But the you come back and you say, what's the intrinsic value? And is it just a higher price? And so I'm a big believer in intrinsic value. Whether it's a bond where you're gonna get your $1,000 and you're gonna get paid interest, a private equity investment, an equity investment, a piece of real estate, all of those have inherent intrinsic value. I may be too naive or dumb to understand it. I don't see the inherent value in these cryptocurrencies. You know, you go back and look at gold over time, you know, and some people think of it as an alternative to gold. I just don't see it. And when I look at long-term returns on gold, not very good. Not very good because, it takes trading. And there is some intrinsic, there's a use of gold, right? It's used in certain things, but jewelry and other things. So I'm a skeptic about it, I have to say. Not an expert by any means, but I come back to where is the intrinsic value other than a higher price from a buyer? Smarter people than me have a different view, but that's my view, Greg. And then somebody will say, you want to put 1% in it. I don't, in your portfolio, I'm not sure why you do that. I'm not sure what 1% does for you.
Well, you know, the things that you've stuck with that are there in book one and book two and will be there in book three, and they're actually the principles that underlie what our private wealth advisors do with clients. I think those are the things that work again and again and again. You know, the thing about being around, I had Bruce Flatt from Brookfield on a month or two ago. And Bruce has been CEO since 2002, generated incredible stock market returns for, yeah, like 3,000% over the time or something. But one of his themes was, you know, we've been around a long time and you get to see things. And first of all, there's always something happening from a macro standpoint. He went through all the things, Jack, that you've had in your career, all the way back to Greenspan raising rates in 94, suddenly 98, long-term capital. There was a Russia crisis then, September 11th, TMT bubble, you know, goes on and on. And then the other thing is, you know, you see things come and they get a lot of traction and you might wonder, well, you know, this is a little bit of a surprise. And then, you know, change happens and they go away. So I think those are really a lot of the principles underlying your books and your philosophy and Vanguard's.
Well, but one of the things I tell people all the time, I say, how old are you? They say, oh, I'm 65. I say, you're a long-term investor. You know, you should live to 90. And so why do you care what happened today in the market? If you have a well-structured portfolio, if you have an advisor that helps you with that, it's noise. That's the hardest thing for people to understand is the noise element. And yeah, there's good noise. Crypto goes the 60,000 or whatever it did, then there's bad noise. But it's all short-term noise. And the reality is nobody's ever, nearly no individuals ever traded themselves to wealth, right? And so how are you going to get there? The risk, the reward you get for taking risk on inherently value creating enterprises is the winning strategy at the end of the day. And it may be, that's why he's done such a great job at Brookfield, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a, but it's hard. It's hard with daily updates. You know, I'm driving in here this morning early and I get what happened in London on NPR before they give you the news at 6 a.m. I mean, it's, you know, interesting, but not relevant, right? But if unless, but you, again, this is one of the reasons, you know, one of the things that surprised people in my, in this second book was, I basically say at a certain point in time, you need an advisor, which is not what I believed 20 years ago, I have to say. Of course, I was 20 years younger then too. And you need an advisor to help you avoid doing something and to set up that portfolio. And that's, again, part of the thing that makes what you guys do gratifying and important.
Well, you know, I have to say, I want to pause on that because it wasn't what you would have said 20 years ago. And you do come out of having been, you know, the person instrumental in building this, you know, Vanguard, which was much more about dealing directly with the client. And, you know, so for you in 2022 to say you need an advisor, and this is, you know, a lot of what our advisors do. They say, wait a minute, take a deep breath. We thought this through. The market's down, but we knew it was going to go down at some point. We have a good plan. Maybe we tweak it and adjust it. But I mean, that is the great part of the advice and counsel that we provide.
I at a Notre Dame event the other day, and man starts talking to me, and he seemed to be quite knowledgeable about certain things, that, like my career, which was uncomfortable. And I said, so what do you do? He says, I'm a financial advisor. And I said, tell me how you do that. He said, I have a singular goal. I have a singular description of what I do. He says, I'm in the behavior modification business. It's a great description. He's a standalone RIA. And people come to him, and you think about how many millionaires get graduate from their company 401k plan every day, right? And they go from being a saver to an investor. And he views his job over the last 35 years as helping people, in some ways, not do the wrong thing,
yeah,
which is, you know, close to doing the right thing, but not doing the wrong thing, he views as far more important than getting any asset allocation right or the selection of an underlying asset. It was a profound, actually, statement. I was impressed that, and we ended up talking about it for a long time, how he does it, and he just couldn't imagine a more gratifying career.
It's a great, I'm going to borrow that one. It's a great description. And you know, if you have world-class advisors, as we do, who care that much about the client, and they're in the, you know, behavior modification where necessary business, it's a huge value added. Let me just shift here. We've got some questions, and these are on topics that I wanted to make sure we touched. So Jackie Klaber, who, as you know, has been instrumental in that investment platform we built, asked the following: as a result of the innovative structures introduced by Vanguard and its peers, passive investing now comprises over 40% of U.S. fund assets and is expected to overtake active investing in the U.S. by 2026. How do you think that passive investing has changed the market landscape and opportunity set for active stock pickers? More broadly, how can passive and active strategies complement one another in portfolios? I think Jackie's talking there about active stock pickers, mostly long only, although we could do long short too, but anyway.
So I'm going to correct her on the passive. It's indexed products because as you read a lot about corporate governance and stuff, you know, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street are not passive. They are indexed. So sorry, Jackie, that's a pet peeve of mine. Listen, I think it's a great thing personally. I think it's the share that indexed assets takes up is good for investors' outcomes because it is a zero-sum game. And if you can take a core of your portfolio and index it to the market, that's a winning strategy for everybody. And people worry that there's not going to be enough float, not be enough liquidity, not be enough lots of stuff. That's just, we're so far from that. It would have to be 95% before that was an issue. So I don't worry about the market implications of that. What I do think is the opportunity, and I said this earlier, it's going to be very hard to run a 98 beta, 99 R squared, actively managed investment product at 100 basis points. It just is. It's harder today. And so what my own sense is, you're going to have large pools of indexed assets, very much complemented with strategies that are long only, concentrated, high risk, high reward. And that mix, I happen to think that's the optimal mix. You can have an entirely indexed portfolio, and that's fine. My own view is you ought to have a core of index no matter who, and then you ought to find the best partners you can find to be the alpha generator for you on that in your aggregate portfolio. You see it already. You see an increasing focus on these specialized concentrated managers. And I think that's a trend that's just going to continue. And you got to pay up for that, by the way. So the combination of your total cost of ownership with a higher cost concentrated investment and an indexed investment is going to result in a very competitive total cost of ownership. And I think it's exactly the way it should go. So, and those investors aren't going to be at all impacted by growing share of indexed in the market channel.
That's great, Jack. Another good question here from Peter Willis. Both in your first book and in today's discussion, you've advised to, quote, tune out the noise and be skeptical of fads, especially in today's media environment with no shortage in options of where to get information. Your NPR reference, Jack, what sources have you gravitated towards as reliable, consistent, and unbiased references for research? Peter Lynch, for example, has previously mentioned he used to simply go sit in a shopping mall and watch the crowd flock to certain stores' products to see where to begin his investment research. Peter, I'll say this, Peter Willis, who sent this question in, you've set the bar very high asking for consistent, reliable, and unbiased references, but let's see if Jack can come up with it.
No, so listen, I actually go to firms. I go to firms' websites. I read what Rockefeller writes. You know, to me, I don't want the middleman. I don't want to hear somebody's interpretation of what somebody's thinking. So I encourage people to go to competitors' websites. You know, and I read every letter that comes in from trusted investment partners. That's where I get most of my information. Because again, I'm not interested in what happened to the Dow in the last week or month or year for that matter. I'm interested in secular trends in economic forecasts grounded in broad perspectives, not narrow. So, you know, I am a skeptic about, you know, you listen to earnings calls and you never hear actual owners of the company on an earnings call. It's always somebody who's incented to have activity where, and that to me is metaphorical for the way you want to go to principals who have skin in the game. And again, I find what I read on the Rockefeller Health Life, Vanguard has very good stuff, spends a lot of money on it. BlackRock has good stuff. That's where I go. And I find, are they unbiased? I don't know, you know, but I think I've got enough skepticism to know what I'm hearing. And to me, I'm always interested in what an owner thinks more than what an agent thinks. That's the difference.
That's excellent. And that gets me to somebody who does a lot of writing for us and I believe is unbiased. Jimmy Chang has a question here that says, and this is a good one, Jack. I think the current macro environment is the most challenging in decades. Jimmy's been in it for decades, so that's a statement. Given your long career on Wall Street, can you think of a prior period that is similar to the present time and what was it like going through that period?
Jimmy's not as old as I am. I was going to mention you specifically as one of the guys I read because I find it both well-written and thoughtful. But, you know, it's interesting now, right? So this is, people call this unprecedented, not Jimmy. Other people call it unprecedented. It's not unprecedented, right? So the stock market went down dramatically in 73, 74, just as inflation and stagflation hit. That it's a period of time that if you want to go back and look and say, what was going on at the time, I would look at 73 to 82. I hope we're not in an 8-year bond stock bear market, but just look at that. That's the period of time. We didn't have the tools or the knowledge we had from an inflation fighting standpoint at that point in time, but it was a brutal period of time. You know, the Dow, I forget when the Dow crossed 1,000 the first time. It was like 1971. Crossed it again in 82. And our friend Duncan McFarlane, who used to run Wellington Management Company, we crossed 1,000 in the Dow, but he's whooping up. He calls me and says, "Hey, fun day, huh?" And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I was your age when it crossed 1,000 the last time." Like, thanks. I appreciate the upper. But you learn from those periods. So that's the period I would look at. You know, most of the people in the fixed income market have never been in a bear market in bonds. Think about it. And then when you've got both, you know, bonds were in the late 70s, they were known as certificates of confiscation. You come in every day and lose money as rates kept rising. So I would look back there, Jimmy, as a place, and there's enough people around who were around in those days that it's worth picking their brains a little bit about it. But I would tell you that I'm much more optimistic. We just didn't have, I don't think we had the intelligence. I don't mean IQ, but intelligence in markets and stuff at the Fed that we have today. And so I don't think we're gonna see another period like we saw after when stagflation hit. But they look back, I'm sure, and say, what did we do right and wrong when there were whiffs of inflation in the 70s, and how did we get out of it? And we're not going to have to bring Paul Volcker in, I don't think, to fix it like he did in 81 and 82.
You know, Jack, that's that period. I mean, I didn't work through it, but uniquely difficult time in our history. Bernanke wrote a letter, I believe, a week or so ago, and he argued against that period occurring now for some of the reasons you just did. He said that there wasn't the political will to fight inflation in the same way. I mean, the Fed has been slow and late, and all that's a problem, but they're unequivocal now. They know they need to break the back of the expectations around inflation. And as Jimmy's been writing and others, obviously the recession risk goes up here because they're willing to take more risk there because they know they got to get this. That didn't exist in the 70s. This is how we avoid repeating it.
Well, exactly. And you can be a Keynesian or a moderatist, you know, whatever you want, but you go back and look what worked and what didn't. And we just didn't, again, the old quote, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And, anyone who doesn't, and you know, I'm sure Chairman Powell, I'm sure he's reaching out to Chairman Bernanke and others, right? And saying, you've seen the Fed, I think, say, you know, we missed it a few times here. That was not the Greenspan Fed. They didn't say we missed it.
Yeah, Jack, a couple more good questions. Another one from Jackie, but I want to ask it because it's an interesting perspective you bring. As the former chairman of FINRA, can you share any insights about how FINRA was and is focused on maintaining the fairness and integrity of public markets? What were some of the areas of focus during your tenure, and where do you think they should be focused and will be focused now?
So let me admit a tremendous bias. I'm a huge fan of FINRA. It's informed regulation. They are good regulators of both distribution and, importantly, markets. But they're informed by engaging with the industry about trends, problems, solutions, and so on. So I come with that bias. And, you know, for me, they keep their ears grounded. I'll give you an example. High frequency trading came under a lot of pressure because somebody, Michael Lewis, wrote a book about it. And, you know, so the political class says, oh my, high frequency trading is bad. High frequency trading is not bad. It closes spreads, it creates liquidity, it does a whole bunch of things. And rather than react and say it's bad, FINRA steps back and takes a look and says, well, maybe there's a tweak here or there, but nothing we didn't know, but we're not gonna slam the door on. And it's just an example of where they have a four-word mantra, which is investor protection, market integrity. Everything they do, and again, I'm not showing for them. It's just, I observe them and I have immense respect for what they do, is driven by those two. That's all they focus on. And it's critically important. They are as knowledgeable, they're as technologically sophisticated on markets themselves as anyone in the country. So I, for one, take great confidence that they oversee markets, especially because they can pick up the phone and call somebody who's running an HFT firm or somebody who's doing this and say, tell me what's going on here. And we will respond, right? You'll respond, Greg. And so, again, for me, it's not quite uniquely American, but it's pretty close to uniquely American, this mix of, you know, private sector, if you will, and public at the SEC. And it's a great combo, but FINRA on the front lines is a huge asset for all of us and our clients and the investors.
As you know, I shared that view when I sat on the board and I was at Morgan Stanley, and I share the view today. I think the phrase enlightened regulation is a good way of describing it, which is ultimately important for the confidence we need investors and the clients on this call to have in markets. Jack, some more topics as we only have 9 minutes and I want to get through them. You often say that growth in a company is good for everyone. Can you please talk about why that is the case in your mind?
You know, obviously we share the malady of being hyper-competitive, right? So
is it a malady?
I put it in quotes. Yes. But you know, you want to win. If you're gonna play, you might as well win. And so if you're winning, you're gonna grow. And so that's part, just start at the macro level. But you know, tangibly, it's unbelievably motivational for the teams. And it attracts great people. Growth attracts great people. And it provides phenomenal career opportunities for people. It provides rewards for people. Hopefully it provides scale, which can be in turn turned into better value for your clients as you grow along. I've known people who say they didn't really want to grow as a firm. And I just can't imagine it, but I've never seen, and growth for growth's sake is not a good thing, by the way. I should caveat that. You know, high quality, principled growth is what I'm talking about. Not, I'm going to do an acquisition, so I'm twice as big. And I'm really talking about organic growth. You know, to me, organic growth is the ultimate winning formula. If you can, you know, you all attract new advisors to Rockefeller and they join us and grow. But it's win-win-win. And I don't know the counter argument, but I've run into more people than I would ever thought I would have over a long career who we're a little apprehensive about growing.
Yeah, we're trying to, as you know, at Rockefeller, have everybody on that page that growth is good for everyone, not for growth's sake, but because it creates a dynamic culture. You can attract really talented people. And if your clients give you more money to manage because you're doing a good job for them, or recommend another client, which happens to us all the time, say, you should talk to this advisor, you should talk to Rockefeller, that's a real statement about the excellence that the organization is bringing forward.
And that's the ultimate statement in that regard. And again, it benefits everybody. You know, scale is undervalued in some ways. You get more money to spend on technology to be better. You get down the reasons that scale, particularly in our business, is important. Scale comes from growth.
Jack, another question thing I wanted to ask you, you've been described as being in a perpetual state of dissatisfaction. And in fact, you like it when people say that about you. I would as well. I'm waiting for that compliment. So can you talk a little bit about why you enjoy hearing that you're in a perpetual state of dissatisfaction?
I describe it as the best insult I ever received. the difference between the person who first laid it on me and me was, she thought it was an insult, I thought it was a compliment. I just think you need to be driven. You know, you want to figuratively die getting better. As an organization, as an individual, as a parent, as a spouse, just fill in the blank. You know, my last conversation with my father before he passed away was a 3-page lecture on what needed to be fixed in the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. because it would screw up the industry he'd spent his career in. This is 2 days before he passed away. And to me, that's the personification of, you know, a perpetual state of dissatisfaction. I'm 93 years old and I am learning and there's change happening and I don't think it's good change, right? So that's all it is. And it's edge and it's a lot of things, but it comes, you know, you come back to be better tomorrow than today and don't look back, learn from what you, but never be nostalgic. That's all.
You know, Einstein said intellectual growth should cease when you leave the world and not until then. It's the same notion. I've got one more for you that Billy Fenrich sent in, which I like. Want to hear what you have to say on this. Billy says, I know you believe in the critical importance of building a good corporate culture. In your view, what are the key ingredients of such a culture? And do you have advice for building and maintaining good culture in organizations that are both A, growing rapidly, we just talked about that, and B, geographically dispersed? He's obviously talking about us and others. So your thoughts on that?
You know, I'd say, and the answer to the second one is, you know, technology and this has really helped, I think, do that, but you can never give up the personal aspects of it, right? So for me, I think you have to have the core things that will not change in culture. Rockefeller, it's integrity, it's client focus. These are the things you talked about when you had your first town halls, right? So you can never accept somebody cutting a corner on any of the core cultural tenets, right? It's fearsome competitiveness. It's however you define it. So to me, it's establishing what will never change in the culture and then enforcing that is the core element, Billy, of how to make culture work. And then it's talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. And then the last thing I would say is role modeling it. You can't say A and do B because people are too smart. People are too smart. And the great organizations, at least in my view, are ones that have a great culture and the overlay is a great mission. And the mission and the culture are completely aligned with one another. And the leaders live it, act it, and communicate it consistently. That would be the way I think about it. And the firms, the organizations, the universities that I admire, whoever, families for that matter, that's the way I think about how you make it happen.
Well, that's a block of sentences that should be put together and listened to. I'm going to get the last 60 seconds in because I want to see what you say about this. Advice to young people today and how has that changed over the course of your career?
I'll say two things, the short answer. One, it's a long game. Don't be in such a hurry. And you see kids who major in three things, got to have an internship as a freshman in college. I say slow down. It's a long game. That's important. The second one that I'm not sure I understood well enough was never lose sight of balance. You define what balance means. It may be a family life and work. It may be this and that. But balance matters. Don't put all your energy into any single aspect of your life. And so those two are lessons of an old man, I guess, versus what I might have been saying 20 or 30 years ago, Greg. And, you know, I hope my kids get it and hear it. And again, the benchmark is the most gratified people I know in their 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s, right? And what did they have? And generally, it's those two things.
You know, what's great about that answer, Jack, is we just went through the perpetual state of dissatisfaction. And then you tagged on alongside that, it's a long game and balance. And they're not in conflict with each other. We speak about that all the time at Rockefeller. I think great companies have people who have all of those things that come together. So really fantastic to have you here. I want to thank you again for being back on. Really terrific to have you come back through 2 years later. Thank you for all you do for Rockefeller Capital Management. Our clients and my colleagues and friends of Rockefeller all know that I always wrap it up with a quotation that hopefully is in sync and symbolizes the guest speaker that we've had. So this one Jack sent me. We trade quotations and lots of things all the time a couple weeks ago, and I loved it. I sent it to a few of my colleagues, but now everybody gets to hear it. So Jack, thanks again for being here. And I leave everybody with Friedrich Nietzsche, who said the following, quote, "He who has a why to live for can bear almost any how," end quote. And I think Jack Brennan has lived that his whole life. So many thanks again for being here, Jack. And we look forward to having our clients and colleagues and other friends of Rockefeller back in the near term. Stay well, everybody. And we'll talk soon.